endings clusters around my head, buzzing like heat insects. "Let us be married, mister," she proposed, and moths of excitement stirred in my guts, as if she had spoken some cabalistic formula, some awesome abracadabra, and released me from my fate. But reality is nagging at me. Love does not conquer all, except in the Bombay talkies. Rip-tear-crunch will not be defeated by a mere ceremony. And optimism is a disease. "On your birthday, how about," she is suggesting. "At 31, a man is a man and is supposed to have a wife." How am I to tell her? How can I say there are other plans for that day? I am, have always been, in the grip of a form-crazy destiny which enjoys wreaking its havoc on numinous days. In short, how am I to tell her about death? I cannot. Instead, meekly and with every appearance of gratitude, I accept her proposal. I am this evening a man newly affianced. Let no one think harshly of me for permitting myself and my betrothed Lotus this last vain, inconsequential pleasure. Padma, by proposing a marriage, revealed her willingness to dismiss everything. I've told her about my past as just so much fancy talk, and when I returned to find Picture Singh beaming in the shadow of a railway bridge, it rapidly became clear that the magicians too were losing their memories. Somewhere in the many moves of the peripatetic slum, they had mislaid their powers of retention, so that now they had become incapable of judgment, having forgotten everything to which they could compare anything that happened. Even the emergency was rapidly being consigned to the oblivion of the past, and the magicians concentrated upon the present with the monomania of snails. Nor did they notice that they had changed. They had forgotten that they had ever been otherwise. Communism had seeped out of them and been gulped down by the thirsty lizard-quick earth. They were beginning to forget their skills in the confusion of hunger, disease, thirst, and police harassment, which constituted, as usual, the present. To me, however, this change in my old companions seemed nothing short of obscene. Salim had come through amnesia and been shown the extent of its immorality. In his mind, the past grew daily more vivid, while the present, from which knives had disconnected him forever, seemed colourless, confused, a thing of no consequence. I, who could remember every hair on the heads of jailers and surgeons, was deeply shocked by the magician's unwillingness to look behind them. "People are like cats," I told my son. "You can't teach them anything." He looked suitably grave, but held his tongue. My son, Adam Sinai, had, when I rediscovered the phantom colony of the illusionists, lost all traces of the tuberculosis which had afflicted his earliest days. I naturally was certain that the disease had vanished with the fall of the widow. Picture Singh, however, told me that credit for the cure must be given to a certain washerwoman, Durga by name, who had wet-nursed him through his sickness, giving him the daily benefit of her inexhaustibly colossal breasts. "That Durga, Captain," the old snake charmer said, his voice betraying the fact that, in his old age, he had fallen victim to the Dhoban's serpentine charms. "What a woman!" She was a woman whose biceps bulged, whose preternatural breasts unleashed a torrent of milk capable of nourishing regiments, and who, it was rumoured darkly, although I suspect the rumour of being started by herself, had two wombs. She was as full of gossip and tittle-tattle as she was of milk. Every day a dozen news stories gushed from her lips. She possessed the boundless energy common to all practitioners of her trade. As she thrashed the life out of shirts and saris on her stone, she seemed to grow in power, as if she were sucking the vigour out of the clothes, which ended up flat, buttonless, and beaten to death. She was a monster who forgot each day the moment it ended. It was with the greatest reluctance that I agreed to make her acquaintance. It is with the greatest reluctance that I admit her into these pages. Her name, even before I met her, had the smell of new things. She represented novelty, beginnings, the advent of new stories, events, complexities, and I was no longer interested in anything new. However, once Picture G informed me that he intended to marry her, I had no option. I shall deal with her, however, as briefly as accuracy permits. Briefly, then, Durga, the washerwoman, was a succubus, a bloodsucker lizard in human form, and her effect on Picture Singh was comparable only to her power over her stone-smashed shirts. In a word, she flattened him. Having once met her, I understood why Picture Singh looked old and forlorn, deprived now of the umbrella of harmony beneath which men and women would gather for advice and shade. He seemed to be shrinking daily. The possibility of his becoming a second hummingbird was vanishing before my very eyes. Durga, however, flourished. Her gossip grew more scatological, her voice louder and more raucous, until at last she reminded me of Reverend Mother in her later years, when she expanded and my grandfather shrank. This nostalgic echo of my grandparents was the only thing of interest to me in the personality of the hoydenish washerwoman. But there is no denying the bounty of her mammary glands. Adam, at 21 months, was still suckling contentedly at her nipples. At first, I thought of insisting that he be weaned, but then remembered that my son did exactly and only what he wished, and decided not to press the point. And, as it transpired, I was right not to do so. As for her supposed double womb, I had no desire to know the truth or otherwise of the story, and made no inquiries. I mentioned Durga the Doban chiefly because it was she who, one evening, when we were eating a meal composed of 27 grains of rice apiece, first foretold my death. I, exasperated by her constant stream of news and chit-chat, had exclaimed, "Durga Bibi, nobody is interested in your stories," to which she, unperturbed, "Salim Baba, I have been good with you because Picture G says you must be in many pieces after your arrest. But, to speak frankly, you do not appear to be concerned with anything except lounging about nowadays. You should understand that when a man loses interest in new matters, he is opening the door for the Black Angel." And although Picture Singh said mildly, "Come now, Captina, don't be rough on the boy," the arrow of Durga the Doban found its mark. In the exhaustion of my drained return, I felt the emptiness of the days coating me in a thick, gelatinous film. And although Durga offered the next morning, and perhaps in a spirit of genuine remorse for her harsh words, to restore my strength by letting me suckle her left breast while my son pulled on the right, "And afterwards, maybe you'll start thinking straight again," intimations of mortality began to occupy most of my thoughts, and then I discovered the mirror of humility at the Shadipur bus depot and became convinced of my approaching demise. It was an angled mirror above the entrance to the bus garage. I, wandering aimlessly in the forecourt of the depot, found my attention caught by its winking reflections of the sun. I realized that I had not seen myself in a mirror for months, perhaps years, and walked across to stand beneath it. Looking upwards into the mirror, I saw myself transformed into a big-headed, top-heavy dwarf. In the humblingly foreshortened reflection of myself, I saw that the hair on my head was now as grey as rain clouds. The dwarf in the mirror, with his lined face and tired eyes, reminded me vividly of my grandfather Adam Aziz on the day he told us about seeing God. In those days, the afflictions cured by Parvati the witch had all, in the aftermath of drainage, returned to plague me. Nine-fingered, horn-templed, monk's tonsured, stain-faced, bow-legged, cucumber-nosed, castrated, and now prematurely aged, I saw in the mirror of humility a human being to whom history could do no more. A grotesque creature who had been released from the preordained destiny which had battered him until he was half senseless. With one good ear and one bad ear, I heard the soft footfalls of the Black Angel of Death. The young old face of the dwarf in the mirror wore an expression of profound relief. I'm becoming gloomy. Let's change the subject. Exactly 24 hours before Panwala's taunt provoked Picture Singh into travelling to Bombay, my son Adam Sinai made the decision which permitted us to accompany the snake charmer on his journey. Overnight, without any warning, and to the consternation of his washerwoman wet nurse, who was obliged to decant her remaining milk into 5-litre Vanaspati drums, flap-eared Adam weaned himself, soundlessly refusing the nipple and demanding, without words, a diet of solid foods. Pulped rice, overboiled lentils, biscuits. It was as though he had decided to permit me to reach my private and now very near finishing line. Mute autocracy of a less than 2-year-old infant. Adam did not tell us when he was hungry or sleepy or anxious to perform his natural functions. He expected us to know. The perpetual attention he required may be one of the reasons why I managed, in spite of all indications to the contrary, to stay alive. Incapable of anything else in those days after my release from captivity, I concentrated on watching my son.
"I tell you, Captain, it's lucky you came back," Picture Singh joked. "Otherwise this one would have turned us all into ayahs."
I understood once again that Adam was a member of a second generation of magical children who would grow up far tougher than the first, not looking for their fate in prophecy or the stars, but forging it in the implacable furnaces of their wills. Looking into the eyes of the child, who was simultaneously not my son, and also more my heir than any child of my flesh could have been, I found in his empty, limpid pupils a second mirror of humility, which showed me that, from now on, mine would be as peripheral a role as that of any redundant oldster. The traditional function, perhaps, of reminiscer, of teller of tales. I wondered if all over the country the bastard sons of Shiva were exerting similar tyrannies upon hapless adults, and envisaged for the second time that tribe of fearsomely potent kiddies, growing, waiting, listening, rehearsing the moment when the world would become their plaything. How these children may in the future be identified, their bimbis stick out instead of in. But it's time to get things moving. A taunt, a last railway train heading south, 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 a final battle. On the day following the weaning of Adam, Salim accompanied Picture Singh to Connaught Place to assist him in his snake charming. Durga the Doban agreed to take my son with her to the Dhobi Ghat. Adam spent the day observing how power was thrashed out of the clothes of the well-to-do and absorbed by the succubus woman. On that fateful day, when the warm weather was returning to the city like a swarm of bees, I was consumed by nostalgia for my bulldozed silver spittoon. Picture Singh had provided me with a spittoon surrogate, an empty Dalda Vanaspati can. But, although I used this to entertain my son with my expertise in the gentle art of spittoon hittery, sending long jets of beetle juice across the grimy air of the magician's colony, I was not consoled. A question. Why such grief over a mere receptacle of juices? My reply is that you should never underestimate a spittoon. Elegant in the salon of the Rani of Kuchnaheen, it permitted intellectuals to practice the art forms of the masses. Gleaming in a cellar, it transformed Nadir Khan's underworld into a second Taj Mahal. Gathering dust in an old tin trunk, it was, nevertheless, present throughout my history. Covertly assimilating incidents in washing chests, ghost visions, freeze-unfreeze, drainage, exiles, falling from the sky like a piece of the moon, it perpetrated a transformation. Oh, talismanic spittoon! Oh, beauteous lost receptacle of memories as well as spittle juice! What sensitive person could fail to sympathize with me in my nostalgic agony at its loss? Beside me at the back of a bus bulging with humanity, Picture Singh sat with snake baskets coiled innocently on his lap. As we rattled and banged through that city which was also filled with the resurgent ghosts of earlier mythological Delhis, the most charming man in the world wore an air of faded despondency, as if a battle in a distant darkroom were already over. Until my return, nobody had understood that Picture G's real and unvoiced fear was that he was growing old, that his powers were dimming, that he would soon be adrift and incompetent in a world he did not understand. Like me, Picture Singh clung to the presence of baby Adam as if the child were a torch in a long, dark tunnel.
"A fine child, Captain," he told me. "A child of dignity. You hardly notice his ears."
That day, however, my son was not with us. New Delhi smells assailed me in Connaught Place. The biscuity perfume of the J.B. Mangaram advertisement, the mournful chalkiness of crumbling plaster, and there was also the tragic spore of the auto rickshaw drivers, starved into fatalism by rising petrol costs, and green grass smells from the circular park in the middle of the whirling traffic, mingled with the fragrance of conmen persuading foreigners to change money on the black market in shadowy archways. From the India Coffee House, under whose marquees could be heard the endless babbling of gossips, there came the less pleasant aroma of new stories beginning. Intrigues, marriages, quarrels, whose smells were all mixed up with those of tea and chili pakoras. What I smelled in Connaught Place, the begging nearby presence of a scar-faced girl who had once been Sundari the Too Beautiful, and loss of memory, and turning towards the future, and nothing really changes. Turning away from these olfactory intimations, I concentrated on the all-pervasive and simpler odours of human, urine and animal dung. Underneath the colonnade of Block F in Connaught Place, next to a pavement bookstall, a panwaller had his little niche. He sat cross-legged behind a green glass counter like a minor deity of the place. I admit him into these last pages because, although he gave off the aromas of poverty, he was, in fact, a person of substance, the owner of a Lincoln Continental motor car, which he parked out of sight in Connaught Circus, and which he had paid for by the fortunes he earned through his sales of contraband-imported cigarettes and transistor radios. For 2 weeks each year, he went to jail for a holiday, and the rest of the time paid several policemen a handsome salary. In jail, he was treated like a king, but behind his green glass counter, he looked inoffensive, ordinary, so that it was not easy, without the benefit of a nose as sensitive as Salim's, to tell that this was a man who knew everything about everything, a man whose infinite network of contacts made him privy to secret knowledge. To me, he provided an additional and not unpleasant echo of a similar character I had known in Karachi during the time of my Lambretta voyages. I was so busy inhaling the familiar perfumes of nostalgia that, when he spoke, he took me by surprise. We had set up our act next to his niche, while Picture G busied himself polishing flutes and donning an enormous saffron turban. I performed the function of Barker. "Roll up, roll up! Once-in-a-lifetime opportunity such as this. Ladies, ladas, come see, come see, come see. Who is here? No common bhangi, no street-sleeping fraud. This, citizens, ladies and gents, is the most charming man in the world. Yes, come see, come see. His photo has been taken by Eastman Kodak Limited. Come close and have no fear. Picture Singh is here." And other such garbage. But then the panwala spoke. "I know of a better act. This fellow is not number one. Oh, no, certainly not. In Bombay there is a better man." That was how Picture Singh learned of the existence of his rival, and why, abandoning all plans of giving a performance, he marched over to the blandly smiling panwala, reaching into the depths of his old voice of command, and said, "You will tell me the truth about this faker, Captain, or I will send your teeth down your gullet until they bite up your stomach." And the panwala, unafraid, aware of the three lurking policemen who would move in swiftly to protect their salaries, if the need arose, whispered to us the secrets of his omniscience, telling us who, when, where, until Picture Singh said in a voice whose firmness concealed his fear, "I will go and show this Bombay fellow who is best. In one world, captains, there is no room for two most charming men." The vendor of betel nut delicacies, shrugging delicately, expectorated at our feet. Like a magic spell, the taunts of a panwala opened the door through which Salim returned to the city of his birth, the abode of his deepest nostalgia. Yes, it was an open sesame, and when we returned to the ragged tents beneath the railway bridge, Picture Singh scrabbled in the earth and dug up the knotted handkerchief of his security, the dirt-discoloured cloth in which he had hoarded pennies for his old age. And when Durga, the washerwoman, refused to accompany him, saying, "What do you think, Picture G? I am a Karorapati rich woman that I can take holidays and what all?" he turned to me with something very like supplication in his eyes and asked me to accompany him so that he did not have to go into his worst battle, the test of his old age, without a friend. Yes, and Adam heard it too, with his flapping ears. He heard the rhythm of the magic. I saw his eyes light up as I accepted, and then we were in a third-class railway carriage heading south, south, south. And in the quinquisyllabic monotony of the wheels, I heard the secret word. Abracadabra, 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 sang the wheels as they bore us back to Bom. Yes, I had left the colony of the magicians behind me forever. I was heading, abracadabra, abracadabra, into the heart of a nostalgia which would keep me alive long enough to write these pages and to create a corresponding number of pickles. Adam and Salim and Picture Singh squeezed into a third-class carriage, taking with us a number of baskets tied up with string. Baskets which alarmed the jam-packed humanity in the carriage by hissing continually, so that the crowds pushed back, 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 away from the menace of the snakes, and allowed us a measure of comfort and space, while the wheels sang their abracadabras to Adam's flapping ears. As we travelled to Bombay, the pessimism of Picture Singh expanded, until it seemed that it had become a physical entity which merely looked like the old snake charmer. At Mathura, an American youth with pustular chin and a head shaved bald as an egg got into our carriage amid the cacophony of hawkers selling earthen animals and cups of cholu chai. He was fanning himself with a peacock feather fan, and the bad luck of peacock feathers depressed Picture Singh beyond imagining. While the infinite flatness of the Indo-Gangetic plain unfolded outside the window, sending the hot insanity of the afternoon loo wind to torment us, the shaven American lectured to occupants of the carriage on the intricacies of Hinduism and began to teach them mantras while extending a walnut begging bowl. Picture Singh was blind to this remarkable spectacle and also deaf to the abracadabra of the wheels.
"It is no good, Captain," he confided mournfully. "This Bombay fellow will be young and strong, and I am doomed to be only the second most charming man from now on."
By the time we reached Kota Station, the odours of misfortune exuded by the peacock feather fan had possessed Picture G utterly, had eroded him so alarmingly that although everyone in the carriage was getting out on the side farthest from the platform to urinate against the side of the train, he showed no sign of needing to go. By Ratlam Junction, while my excitement was mounting, he had fallen into a trance, which was not sleep, but the rising paralysis of the pessimism. At this rate, I thought, he won't even be able to challenge this rival. Baroda passed, no change. At Surat, the old John Company depot, I realised I'd have to do something soon, because abracadabra was bringing us closer to Bombay Central by the minute, and so at last I picked up Picture Singh's old wooden flute, and by playing it with such terrible ineptitude that all the snakes writhed in agony and petrified the American youth into silence, by producing a noise so hellish that nobody noticed the passing of Bassian Road, Kurla, Mahim, I overcame the miasma of the peacock feathers. At last, Picture Singh shook himself out of his despondency with a faint grin and said,
"Better you stop, Captain, and let me play that thing. Otherwise some people are sure to die of pain."
Serpents subsided in their baskets, and then the wheels stopped singing, and we were there. Bombay! I hugged Adam fiercely and was unable to resist uttering an ancient cry, "Back to Bomb!" I cheered to the bewilderment of the American youth, who had never heard this mantra, and again and again and again, "Back, back to Bomb!" By bus down Belasis Road, towards the Tardeo roundabout, we travelled past Parsis with sunken eyes, past bicycle repair shops and Irani cafes, and then Hornby Vallard was on our right, where promenaders watched as Sherry the mongrel bitch was left to spill her guts. where cardboard effigies of wrestlers still towered above the entrances to Vallabhbhai Patel Stadium. And we were rattling and banging past traffic cops with sun umbrellas, past Mahalakshmi Temple, and then Warden Road. The breech candy swimming baths, and there, look, the shops, but the names had changed. Where was Reader's Paradise, with its stacks of Superman comics? Where the bandbox laundry, and Bombellis with their 1 yard of chocolates? And my God, look! Atop a two-story hillock, where once the palaces of William Methil stood wreathed in bougainvillea and stared proudly out to sea, look at it! A great pink monster of a building, the roseate skyscraper obelisk of the Nalaka women standing over and obliterating the circus ring of childhood. Yes, it was my Bombay, but also not mine, because we reached Kemp's Corner to find the hoardings of Air India's little Raja and of the Kolinos kid gone. Gone for good. And Thomas Kemp and Company itself had vanished into thin air. Flyovers crisscrossed where, once upon a time, medicines were dispensed and a pixie in a chlorophyll cap beamed down upon the traffic. Elegiacally, I murmured under my breath, "Keep teeth clean and keep teeth bright, keep teeth Kolinos super white." But despite my incantation, the past failed to reappear. We rattled on down Gibbs Road and dismounted near Chowpatty Beach. Chowpatty, at least, was much the same. A dirty strip of sand aswarm with pickpockets and strollers and vendors of hot chana chana hot, of kulfi and belpuri and chatamata. But further down Marine Drive I saw what tetrapods had achieved. On land reclaimed by the Nalaka Consortium from the sea, vast monsters soared upwards to the sky, bearing strange alien names. Oberoi, Sheraton, screamed at me from afar. And where was the neon jeep sign? "Come on, Picture G," I said at length, hugging Adam to my chest. "Let's go where we're going and be done with it. The city has been changed." What can I say about the Midnight Confidential Club? That its location is underground? Secret, although known to omniscient Panwallas. Its door unmarked. Its clientele the cream of Bombay society. What else? Ah, yes. Managed by one Anand, Andy, Shroff, businessman playboy, who is to be found on most days tanning himself at the Sun and Sand Hotel on Juhu Beach, amid film stars and disenfranchised princesses. I ask you, an Indian sunbathing? But apparently it's quite normal. The international rules of playboydom must be obeyed to the letter, including, I suppose, the one stipulating daily worshipping of the sun. How innocent I am! And I used to think that sunny, forcep-dented was the simple one. I never suspected that places like the Midnight Confidential existed. But of course they do. And clutching flutes and snake baskets, the three of us knocked on its doors. Movements visible through a small iron-eye-level grill. A low, mellifluous female voice asked us to state our business. Picture Singh announced, "I am the most charming man in the world. You are employing here one other snake charmer as cabaret. I will challenge him and prove my superiority. For this, I do not ask to be paid. It is, Captina, a question of honour." It was evening. Mr. Anand Andy Shroff was, by good fortune, on the premises. And, to cut a long story short, Picture Singh's challenge was accepted. And we entered that place whose name had already unnerved me somewhat, because it contained the word Midnight, and because its initials had once concealed my own secret world, MCC, which stands for Metro Cub Club, once also stood for the Midnight Children's Conference, and had now been usurped by the secret night spot. In a word, I felt invaded. Twin problems of the city's sophisticated, cosmopolitan youth. How to consume alcohol in a dry state, and how to romance girls in the best Western tradition by taking them out to paint the town red while, at the same time, preserving total secrecy to avoid the very oriental shame of a scandal. The Midnight Confidential was Mr. Schroff's solution to the agonizing difficulties of the city's gilded youth. In that underground of licentiousness, he had created a world of Stygian darkness, black as hell. In the secrecy of midnight darkness, the city's lovers met, drank imported liquor, and romanced. Cocooned in the isolating artificial night, they canoodled with impunity. Hell is other people's fantasies. Every saga requires at least one descent into Jahannum, and I followed Picture Singh into the inky negritude of the club, holding an infant son in my arms. We were led down a lush black carpet. Midnight black as lies, crow black, anger black, the black of hi, you're black man. In short, a dark rug, by a female attendant of ravishing sexual charms, who wore her sari erotically low on her hips, with a jasmine in her navel. But as we descended into the darkness, she turned towards us with a reassuring smile, and I saw that her eyes were closed. Unearthly luminous eyes had been painted on her lids. I could not help but ask, why? To which she simply, I am blind, and besides, nobody who comes here wants to be seen. Here you are in a world without faces or names. Here people have no memories, families or past. Here is for now, for nothing except right now. And the darkness engulfed us. She guided us through that nightmare pit in which light was kept in shackles and bar fetters, that place outside time, that negation of history. Sit here, she said. The other snake man will come soon. When it is time, one light will shine on you. Then begin your contest. We sat there for what? Minutes? Hours? Weeks? And there were the glowing eyes of blind women leading invisible guests to their seats. And gradually, in the dark, I became aware of being surrounded by soft, amorous susurrations, like the couplings of velvet mice. I heard the chink of glasses held by twined arms and gentle brushings of lips, with one good ear and one bad ear. I heard the sound of illicit sexuality filling the midnight air. But no, I did not want to know what was happening, although my nose was able to smell, in the susurrating silence of the club, all manner of new stories and beginnings of exotic and forbidden loves, and little invisible contretemps, and who was going too far. In fact, all sorts of juicy titbits. I chose to ignore them all, because this was a new world in which I had no place. My son, Adam, however, sat beside me with ears burning with fascination. His eyes shone in the darkness as he listened and memorized and learned. And then there was light. A single shaft of light spilled into a pool on the floor of the Midnight Confidential Club. From the shadows beyond the fringe of the illuminated area, Adam and I saw Picture Singh sitting stiffly, cross-legged, next to a handsome, brill-creamed youth. Each of them was surrounded by musical instruments and the closed baskets of their art. A loudspeaker announced the beginning of that legendary contest for the title of Most Charming Man in the World. But who was listening? Did anyone even pay attention? Or were they too busy with lips, tongues, hands? This was the name of Picture G's opponent, the Maharaja of Kuchnaheen. I don't know. It's easy to assume a title, but perhaps, he really was the grandson of that old Rani who had once, long ago, been a friend of Dr. Aziz. Perhaps the heir to the supporter of the hummingbird was pitted, ironically, against the man who might have been the second Mian Abdullah. It's always possible. Many Maharajas have been poor since the widow revoked their civil list salaries. How long in that sunless cavern did they struggle? Months, years, centuries? I cannot say. I watched, mesmerized, as they strove to outdo one another, charming every kind of snake imaginable, asking for rare varieties to be sent from the Bombay snake farm, where once Dr. Shapstecker and the Maharaja matched Picture Singh, snake for snake, succeeding even in charming constrictors. which only Picture G had previously managed to do. In that infernal club, whose darkness was another aspect of its proprietor's obsession with the colour black, under whose influence he tanned his skin darker, darker every day at the Sun and Sand, the two virtuosi goaded snakes into impossible feats, making them tie themselves in knots or bows, or persuading them to drink water from wine glasses and to jump through fiery hoops. Defying fatigue, hunger, and age, Picture Singh was putting on the show of his life. But was anyone looking? Anyone at all? And at last it became clear that the younger man was tiring first. His snakes ceased to dance in time to his flute, and finally, through a piece of sleight of hand so fast that I did not see what happened, Picture Singh managed to knot a king cobra around the Maharaja's neck. What Picture said, "Give me best, Captain, or I'll tell it to bite." That was the end of the contest. The humiliated princeling left the club and was later reported to have shot himself in a taxi. And on the floor of his last great battle, Picture Singh collapsed like a falling banyan tree. Blind attendants, to one of whom I entrusted Adam, helped me carry him from the field. But the Midnight Confidential had one trick left up its sleeve. Once a night, just to add a little spice, a roving spotlight searched out one of the illicit couples and revealed them to the hidden eyes of their fellows. A touch of luminary Russian roulette, which, no doubt, made life more thrilling for the city's young cosmopolitans. And who was the chosen victim that night? Who, horn-templed, stain-faced, cucumber-nosed, was drowned in scandalous light? Who, made as blind as female attendants by the voyeurism of light bulbs, almost dropped the legs of his unconscious friend? Salim returned to the city of his birth to stand illuminated in a cellar, while Bombayites tittered at him from the dark. Quickly now, because we have come to the end of incidents, I record that, in a back room in which light was permitted, Picture Singh recovered from his fainting fit, and while Adam slept soundly, one of the blind waitresses brought us a congratulatory reviving meal. On the Thali of Victory, samosas, pakoras, rice, dal, puris, and green chutney. Yes, a little aluminium bowl of chutney. Green, my God, green as grasshoppers. And before long a puri was in my hand, and chutney was on the puri. And then I had tasted it, and almost imitated the fainting act of Picture Singh, because it carried me back to a day when I emerged, nine-fingered from a hospital, and went into exile at the home of Hanif Aziz, and was given the best chutney in the world. The taste of the chutney was more than just an echo of that long-ago taste. It was the old taste itself, the very same, with the power of bringing back the past as if it had never been away. In frenzy of excitement, I grabbed the blind waitress by the arm. Scarcely able to contain myself, I blurted out, "The chutney! Who made it?" I must have shouted because, "Picture,
quiet, Captain, you wake the boy. And what's the matter? You look like you saw your worst enemy's ghost."
And the blind waitress, a little coldly, "You don't like the chutney?" I had to hold back an almighty bellow. "I like it," I said in a voice caged in bars of steel. "I like it. Now will you tell me where it's from?" And she, alarmed, anxious to get away, "It's Braganza pickle, best in Bombay, everyone knows." I made her bring me the jar, and there, on the label, was the address of a building with a winking saffron and green neon goddess over the gate, a factory watched over by neon Mumba Devi, while local trains went yellow and browning past. Braganza Pickles Private Limited, in the sprawling north of the town. Once again, an abracadabra, an open sesame, words printed on a chutney jar opening the last door of my life. I was seized by an irresistible determination to track down the maker of that impossible chutney of memory, and said, "Picture G, I must go." I do not know the end of the story of Picture Singh. He refused to accompany me on my quest. and I saw in his eyes that the efforts of his struggle had broken something inside him, that his victory was, in fact, a defeat. But whether he is still in Bombay, perhaps working for Mr. Shroff, or back with his washerwoman, whether he is still alive or not, I am not able to say. How can I leave you? I asked desperately, but he replied,
Don't be a fool, Captain. You have something you must do, then there is nothing to do but do it. Go, go. What do I want with you? Like all Resham told you, go, go quickly, go.
Taking Adam with me, I went. Journey's End. From the underworld of the blind waitresses, I walked north, 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 holding my son in my arms, and came at last to where flies are gobbled by lizards, and vats bubble, and strong-armed women tell bawdy jokes to this world of sharp-lipped overseers with conical breasts, and the all-pervasive clank of pickle jars from the bottling plant. And who, at the end of my road, planted herself in front of me, arms akimbo, hair glistening with perspiration on the forearms. Who, direct as ever, demanded, You, mister, what you want?
Me? Padma is yelling, excited and a little embarrassed by the memory. Of course, who else? Me, me, me.
Good afternoon, Begum, I said. Padma interjects,
Oh, you, always so polite and all.
Good afternoon. May I speak to the manager?
Oh, grim, defensive, obstinate Padma. Not possible. Manager Begum is busy. You must make appointment. Come back later, so please go away just now.
Listen, I would have stayed, persuaded, bullied, even used force to get past my Padma's arms. But there was a cry from the catwalk. This catwalk, Padma, outside the offices. The catwalk from which someone whom I have not been willing to name until now was looking down across gigantic pickle vats and simmering chutneys. Someone rushing down clattering metal steps, shrieking at the top of a voice,
Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, Jesus, sweet Jesus! Baba, my son! Look who's come here! Are Baba! Don't you see me? Look how thin you got. Come, come, let me kiss you. Let me give you cake.
Just as I had guessed, the manager Begum of Braganza Pickles Private Limited, who called herself Mrs. Braganza, was, of course, my erstwhile ire, the criminal of midnight, Miss Mary Pereira, the only mother I had left in the world. Midnight, or thereabouts. A man carrying a folded and intact black umbrella walks towards my window from the direction of the railway tracks, stops, squats, shits, then sees me silhouetted against light and, instead of taking offence at my voyeurism, calls, Watch this! And proceeds to extrude the longest turd I have ever seen.
15 inches, he calls. How long can you make yours?
Once, when I was more energetic, I would have wanted to tell his life story, the hour, and his possession of an umbrella. Would have been all the connections I needed to begin the process of weaving him into my life. And I have no doubt that I'd have finished by proving his indispensability to anyone who wishes to understand my life and benighted times. But now I'm disconnected, unplugged, with only epitaphs left to write. So, waving at the champion defecator, I call back, 7 on a good day, and forget him. Tomorrow, or the day after, the cracks will be waiting for August 15th. There is still a little time. I'll finish tomorrow. Today I gave myself the day off and visited Mary. A long, hot, dusty bus ride through streets beginning to bubble with the excitement of the coming Independence Day. Although I can smell other, more tarnished perfumes, disillusion, venality, cynicism. The nearly 31-year-old myth of freedom is no longer what it was. New myths are needed. But that's none of my business. Mary Pereira, who now calls herself Mrs. Braganza, lives with her sister Alice, now Mrs. Fernandez, in an apartment in the pink obelisk of the Nalaka women on the two-story hillock where once, In a demolished palace, she slept on a servant's mat. Her bedroom occupies more or less the same cube of air in which a fisherman's pointing finger led a pair of boyish eyes out towards the horizon. In a teak rocking chair, Mary rocks my son, singing, "Red sails in the sunset. Red dhow sails spread against the distant sky." A pleasant enough day, on which old days are recalled. The day when I realized that an old cactus bed had survived the revolution of the Nalako women, and borrowing a spade from the Mali, dug up a long-buried world. A tin globe containing yellowed, ant-eaten, jumbo-sized baby snap, credited to Kalidas Gupta and a Prime Minister's letter. And days further off, for the dozenth time we chatter about the change in Mary Pereira's fortunes. How she owed it all to her dear Alice, whose poor Mr. Fernandez died of colour blindness, having become confused in his old Ford Prefect at one of the city's then few traffic lights. How Alice visited her in Goa with the news that her employers, the fearsome and enterprising Nalaka women, were willing to put some of their tetrapod money into a pickle firm. "I told them, nobody makes achar chutney like our Mary," Alice had said, with perfect accuracy. "Because she puts her feelings inside them." So, Alice turned out to be a good girl in the end. And Baba, what do you think? How could I believe the whole world would want to eat my poor pickles? Even in England they eat. And now, just think, I sit here where your dear house used to be, while God knows what all has happened to you, living like a beggar so long. What a world, Bapure! And bittersweet lamentations. Oh, your poor mummy daddy, that fine madam dead, and the poor man never knowing who loved him or how to love, and even the monkey. But I interrupt. No, not dead. No, not true. Not dead. Secretly in a nunnery, eating bread. Mary, who has stolen the name of poor Queen Catherine, who gave these islands to the British, taught me the secrets of the pickling process. Finishing an education which began in this very airspace when I stood in a kitchen as she stirred gilt into green chutney. Now she sits at home, retired in her white-haired old age, once more happy as an ayah with a baby to raise. "Now you've finished your writing, Baba. You should take more time for your son." "But Mary, I did it for him." And she, switching the subject because her mind makes all sorts of flea jumps these days. "Oh, Baba, look at you. How old you got already." Rich Mary, who never dreamed she would be rich, is still unable to sleep on beds, but drinks 16 Coca-Colas a day, unworried about teeth, which have all fallen out anyway. A flea jump. "Why are you getting married so sudden? "Because Padma wants." "No, she is not in trouble. How could she in my condition?" "Okay, Baba, I only asked." And the day would have wound down peacefully, a twilight day near the end of time, except that now, at last, at the age of 3 years, 1 month and 2 weeks, Adam Sinai uttered a sound. Are. Oh, my God, listen, Baba, the boy is saying something. And Adam, very carefully, "Abba, Father." He is calling me Father. But no, he has not finished. There is strain on his face, and finally my son, who will have to be a magician to cope with the world I'm leaving him, completes his awesome first word. Gadabba. Abracadabra. But nothing happens. We do not turn into toads. Angels do not fly in through the window. The lad is just flexing his muscles. I shall not see his miracles. Amid Mary's celebrations of Adam's achievement, I go back to Padma and the factory. My son's enigmatic first incursion into language has left a worrying fragrance in my nostrils. Abracadabra. Not an Indian word at all. A Kabbalistic formula derived from the name of the supreme god of the Basilidan Gnostics, containing the number 365, the number of the days of the year, and of the heavens, and of the spirits emanating from the god Abraxas. Who, I am wondering, not for the first time, does the boy imagine he is? My special blends. I've been saving them up. Symbolic value of the pickling process. All the 600 million eggs which gave birth to the population of India could fit inside a single standard-sized pickle jar. 600 million spermatozoa could be lifted on a single spoon. Every pickle jar, you will forgive me if I become florid for a moment, contains, therefore, the most exalted of possibilities, the feasibility of the chutneyfication of history, the grand hope of the pickling of time. I, however, have pickled chapters. Tonight, by screwing the lid firmly onto a jar bearing the legend, Special Formula Number 30, Abracadabra, I reach the end of my long-winded autobiography. In words and pickles, I have immortalized my memories. Although distortions are inevitable in both methods, we must live, I'm afraid, with the shadows of imperfection. These days, I manage the factory for Mary. Alice, Mrs. Fernandez, controls the finances. My responsibility is for the creative aspects of our work. Of course, I have forgiven Mary her crime. I need mothers as well as fathers, and a mother is beyond blame. Amid the holy female workforce of Braganza Pickles, beneath the saffron and green winking of neon Mamba Devi, I choose mangoes, tomatoes, limes from the women who come at dawn with baskets on their heads. Mary, with her ancient hatred of the men's, admits no males except myself into her new, comfortable universe. Myself, and of course, my son. Alice, I suspect, still has her little liaisons. And Padma fell for me from the first, seeing in me an outlet for her vast reservoir of pent-up solicitude. I cannot answer for the rest of them, but the formidable competence of the Nalaka females is reflected on this factory floor in the strong-armed dedication of the vat-stirrers. What is required for chutneyfication? Raw materials, obviously. Fruit, vegetables, fish, vinegar, spices. Daily visits from Kohli women with their saris hitched up between their legs. Cucumbers, aubergines, mint, but also eyes, blue as ice, which are undeceived by the superficial blandishments of fruit, which can see corruption beneath citrus skin. Fingers which, with the featheriest touch, can probe the secret inconstant hearts of green tomatoes, and above all, a nose, capable of discerning the hidden languages of what must be pickled, its humours and messages and emotions. At Braganza Pickles, I supervise the production of Mary's legendary recipes. But there are also my special blends in which, thanks to the powers of my drained nasal passages, I am able to include memories, dreams, ideas, so that once they enter mass production, all who consume them will know what pepper pots achieved in Pakistan, or how it felt to be in the Sundarbans. Believe, don't believe, but it's true. 30 jars stand upon a shelf, waiting to be unleashed upon the amnesiac nation. And beside them, one jar stands empty. The process of revision should be constant and endless. Don't think I'm satisfied with what I've done. Among my unhappiness, an overly harsh taste from those jars containing memories of my father, a certain ambiguity in the love flavour of Jamila Singer, Special Formula Number 22, which might lead the unperceptive to conclude that I've invented the whole story of the baby swap to justify an incestuous love. Vague implausibilities in the jar labelled accident in a washing chest. The pickle raises questions which are not fully answered, such as, why did Salim need an accident to acquire his powers? Most of the other children didn't. Or again, in All India Radio and others. A discordant note in the orchestrated flavours. Would Mary's confession have come as a shock to a true telepath? Sometimes, in the Pickles version of history, Salim appears to have known too little, at other times, too much. Yes, I should revise, and revise, improve and improve. But there is neither the time nor the energy. I am obliged to offer no more than this stubborn sentence. It happened that way because that's how it happened. There is also the matter of the spice bases, the intricacies of turmeric and cumin, the subtlety of fenugreek, when to use large and when small, cardamoms, the myriad possible effects of garlic, garam masala, stick cinnamon, coriander, ginger, not to mention the flavorful contributions of the occasional speck of dirt. Salim is no longer obsessed with purity. In the spice bases, I reconcile myself to the inevitable distortions of the pickling process. To pickle is to give immortality, after all. Fish, vegetables, fruit hang embalmed in spice and vinegar. A certain alteration, a slight intensification of taste, is a small matter, surely. The art is to change the flavour in degree, but not in kind, and above all, in my 30 jars and a jar, to give it shape and form, that is to say, meaning. I have mentioned my fear of absurdity. One day, perhaps, the world may taste the pickles of history. They may be too strong for some palates. Their smell may be overpowering. Tears may rise to eyes. I hope, nevertheless, that it will be possible to say of them that they possess the authentic taste of truth, that they are, despite everything, acts of love. One empty jar. How to end? Happily with Mary in her teak rocking chair and a son who has begun to speak, amid recipes and 30 jars with chapter headings for names, in melancholy, drowning in memories of Jamila and Parvati and even of Evie Burns, or with the magic children. But then, should I be glad that some escaped or end in the tragedy of the disintegrating effects of drainage? Because in drainage lie the origins of the cracks. My hapless pulverized body, drained above and below, began to crack because it was dried out. Parched, it yielded at last to the effects of a lifetime's battering. And now there is rip-tear crunch and a stench issuing through the fissures, which must be the smell of death. Control. I must retain control as long as possible. Or with questions. Now that I can, I swear, see the cracks on the backs of my hands, cracks along my hairline and between my toes, why do I not bleed? Am I already so empty, desiccated, pickled? Am I already the mummy of myself? Or dreams? Because last night, the ghost of Reverend Mother appeared to me, staring down through the hole in a perforated cloud, waiting for my death so that she could weep a monsoon for 40 days, and I, floating outside my body, looked down on the foreshortened image of myself and saw a grey-haired dwarf who once, in a mirror, looked relieved. No, that won't do. I shall have to write the future as I have written the past, to set it down with the absolute certainty of a prophet. But the future cannot be preserved in a jar. One jar must remain empty. What cannot be pickled, because it has not taken place, is that I shall reach my birthday, 31 today, and no doubt a marriage will take place, and Padma will have henna tracery on her palms and soles, and also a new name, perhaps Nazim, in honour of Reverend Mother's watching ghost. And outside the window there will be fireworks and crowds, because it will be Independence Day, and the many-headed multitudes will be in the streets, and Kashmir will be waiting. I will have train tickets in my pocket. There will be a taxi cab driven by a country boy who once dreamed at the Pioneer Cafe of film stardom. We will drive south, south, south into the heart of the tumultuous crowds, who will be throwing balloons of paint at each other, at the wound-up windows of the cab, as if it were the day of the paint festival of Holi. And along Hornby Vellard, where a dog was left to die, the crowd, the dense crowd, the crowd without boundaries, growing until it fills the world, will make progress impossible. We will abandon our taxicab and the dreams of its driver, on our feet in the thronging crowd. And yes, I will be separated from Padma, my dung lotus, extending an arm towards me across the turbulent sea, until she drowns in the crowd, and I am alone in the vastness of the numbers marching 1, 2, 3. I am being buffeted right and left while rip, tear, crunch reaches its climax, and my body is screaming. It cannot take this kind of treatment any more. But now I see familiar faces in the crowd. They are all here. My grandfather, Adam, and his wife, Nazim, and Alia, and Mustafa, and Hanif, and Emerald, and Amina, who was Mumtaz, and Nadia, who became Kasim, and Pierre, and Zafar, who wet his bed, and also General Zulfikar. They throng around me, pushing, shoving, crushing. And the cracks are widening. Pieces of my body are falling off. There is Jamila, who has left her nunnery to be present on this last day. Night is falling, has fallen. There is a countdown, tick-tocking to midnight. Fireworks and stars, the cardboard cutouts of wrestlers. And I see that I shall never reach Kashmir. Like Jehangir, the Mughal emperor, I shall die with Kashmir on my lips. Unable to see the Valley of Delights, to which men go to enjoy life, or to end it, or both. Because now I see other figures in the crowd. The terrifying figure of a war hero with lethal knees, who has found out how I cheated him of his birthright. He is pushing towards me through the crowd, which is now wholly composed of familiar faces. There is Rashid the rickshaw boy, arm in arm with the Rani of Kuchnaheen, and Ayuba, Shahid, Farooq, with Mutasim the Handsome. And from another direction, the direction of Haji Ali's island tomb, I see a mythological apparition approaching. The Black Angel. Except that, as it nears me, its face is green, its eyes are black, a centre parting in its hair, on the left green and on the right black. Its eyes, the eyes of widows. Shiva and the angel are closing. Closing, I hear lies being spoken in the night. Anything you want to be, you can be. The greatest lie of all. Cracking now, fission of Salim. I am the bomb in Bombay. Watch me explode. Bones splitting, breaking beneath the awful pressure of the crowd. Bag of bones falling down, down, down. Just as once at Jallianwala. But Dyer seems not to be present today. No Mercurochrome, only a broken creature spilling pieces of itself into the street, because I have been so many, too many persons. Life, unlike syntax, allows one more than three. And at last, somewhere, the striking of a clock, 12 chimes release. Yes, they will trample me underfoot. The numbers marching 1, 2, 3, 400 million, 506, reducing me to specks of voiceless dust, just as, all in good time, they will trample my son, who is not my son, and his son, who will not be his, and his, who will not be his, until the 1001st generation, until 1001 midnights have bestowed their terrible gifts, and 1001 children have died, because it is the privilege and the curse of midnight's children to be both masters and victims of their times, to forsake privacy and be sucked into the annihilating whirlpool of the multitudes, and to be unable to live or die in peace.
You have been listening to Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie, narrated by Lyndon Gregory.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.